Okay, my name's Ben Denham, and I'd like to introduce you to the very first episode of This Week in Entomology. Actually, no, that's not true. As much as I wish there was a podcast called This Week in Entomology, so far as I know, it doesn't exist. There is, however, a podcast called This Week in Microbiology, and one called This Week in Virology, and another called This Week in Parasitism, and another called This Week in Evolution. Now, all of these podcasts are hosted by a guy called Vincent Racaniello, clearly a very busy guy, and we're going to hear material that I've recycled from two of those podcasts, This Week in Virology and This Week in Microbiology. You can find both of these podcasts at microbe.tv. We're also going to hear material from a podcast that science journalist Carl Zimmer used to do for the American Society of Microbiology. That podcast is called Meet the Scientist, and you can find it at microbeworld.org. So this isn't This Week in Entomology, but we are going to talk about aphids and an even bigger subject. So, what is that subject?
The subject here is endosymbiosis.
That was Ilio Schechter speaking on the This Week in Microbiology podcast. So what exactly is endosymbiosis? We've actually got the Greeks to thank for the term. It's a compound of endon, meaning within, syn, together, and biosis, meaning living. So it is living within and together. In slightly more concrete terms, it refers to a kind of symbiosis where one organism lives inside of another. And this is happening everywhere in the biological world.
And it deals at least more than tangentially, with a great subject, namely the origin of eukaryotic cells by endosymbiosis.
Today, we're going to be thinking about microbiology as it applies to our own cells and the cells of our insect friends.
The notion that endosymbionts became mitochondria and chloroplast is now widely accepted. It is not something that's a subject of debate. It's part of what we all believe.
The idea here is that a bunch of previously free-living bacterial species got together to make up our cells. This is a big deal. Just how big a deal is it? I'm going to let Helio explain.
It's really a grand subject because this was one of the grandest events in the history of living things.
One of the grandest events in the history of living things. That's a pretty big deal.
I think it really ranks second in my mind to the origin of life. Life originated, and then sometime later, about a billion or 2 years later, eukaryotic cells arose by endosymbiosis, by one cell eating another cell, and the one that got eaten becoming an organelle in time.
So yes, this is a big deal, and it turns out that we can find out something about it by looking inside of insects. Here's science journalist Carl Zimmer.
So when you talk about these bacteria in these sharpshooters, I'm reminded of our own cells.
He's in the middle of a conversation with evolutionary biologist Nancy Moran. We'll hear from her later.
So we have mitochondria in our cells, and these are little sausage-shaped organelles that help to generate energy for the cell to sort of create our fuel. And they actually have their own DNA as well. And scientists have looked at mitochondria and figured out that they also started out as bacteria that got trapped in our cells and really just became a part of our cells.
So we're going to hear about how the bacteria that live inside of insects are similar to those bacteria that became our mitochondria. But let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. First, we need to dwell a little longer on just how big a deal the origin of the eukaryotic cell is.
Okay, so I find this to be an incomparable event. It is magnificent in that in a single step, an awful lot of things happen. The acquisition of a whole bunch of biochemical pathways and the establishment of eukaryotic cells as a consequence. So it's grand. And I think what we know about it is limited because it happened a couple or so billion years ago, and it happens suddenly.
So what about that connection between insects and mitochondria?
So I'm wondering, are there any similarities between what's happening with the bacteria in these sharpshooters and what happened to mitochondria in our own cells?
And this is Nancy Moran.
There are a lot of similarities, and sometimes people like to debate when do you cross from being a symbiont to an organelle, such as a mitochondrion.
So there's the question of when you cross that line, but there's also the question of how you cross it. And unfortunately,
we do not have intermediate steps. We don't know of intermediate steps. So here is a paper that deals with possible intermediate steps, with something that is maybe on the way of an endosymbiont becoming an organelle.
So it's the insects that can help us with these intermediate steps. At this point, we can introduce the stars of this show, the aphid and its endosymbiont.
Buchnera is the name of the endosymbiont. It exists in aphids, which have a problem. They feed on plant sap, which is short on amino acids, and the aphids can only make certain amino acids and not all, just like we do. We need essential amino acids in our diet. Same for aphids, but they don't get it in the diet. So instead, they have acquired an endosymbiotic bacterium, which can do just that.
A side note on Buchnera, it can only live inside of the cells of aphids. In fact, this lifestyle has meant that over millions of years, it's lost a whole range of genes that it would need to live in the outside world. So it's completely dependent on the aphid for its survival. And in turn, the aphid depends on it because
it makes the amino acids which the aphid needs and feeds it. So if you were to treat aphids with an antibiotic that gets rid of the endosymbiont, they would starve to death because they wouldn't have enough amino acids to make the protein.
So Buchnera allows aphids to live in a plant sap feeding niche where they would otherwise starve to death. The fact that Buchnera lives inside of the cells of aphids makes it similar to mitochondria in many ways. But there are some important differences.
In mitochondria, we know that some ancestral genes that were bacterial genes of the bacterial ancestor of mitochondria, some of those genes migrated to the host genome. So they actually made the jump from being in the bacterial chromosome and somehow were put into the host genome.
So one bacteria moves inside of the cells of another and realizes that there's a place where it can put some of the genes that it uses to reproduce.
The genes from the endosymbiont have been transferred en masse to the nucleus of the host cell.
So the endosymbiont makes a deposit of genes, and in return, it gets back a bunch of proteins.
The genes are maintained, and then the products of those genes are imported back into the compartment, the mitochondrial compartment, where they can act to do functions that are needed there.
So there is a circle here. The gene goes from the symbiont to the nucleus. The nuclear genes encode for a protein, the protein goes back to the endosymbiont. For the circuit to work, it requires that proteins made by now nuclear genes, which used to be bacterial genes, are capable of being transferred into the organelle or the endosymbiont, if you wish. And that requires that there are a specific, perhaps, or at least a dedicated system of transport. And sure enough, signal sequences are seen at the amino terminus, which suggests that many of these proteins are capable of being transported. Well, they are, we know that, but how is the question? This has been known for organelles, mitochondria and plastids. They acquire proteins from genes which they have donated previously being billions of years ago, to the nucleus.
And so that's happened with a large number of mitochondrial genes. So there's a special import machinery that proteins can be targeted to the mitochondria and can go back in there and do their work there.
So this is where we come to the differences between bacteria in insects and mitochondria.
That's the thing we haven't found yet in these symbionts of insects, and there's several reasons for why that might be. The insect symbionts, they originated, they're ancient, but they're not as ancient as mitochondria, right? Mitochondria originated in a single-celled ancestor to all of the eukaryotes. Okay, before there were animals, before there were multicellular plants, mitochondria originated. Therefore, they were actually, those symbionts were actually in the same cell, the single cell, with the genome of the host. There was no separate germ line. There was no multicellularity. It was a relatively simple situation where a bacterium went into the ancestral cell of the eukaryotes and was living side by side with the genome of that cell. And that might have increased the opportunities for gene transfer to occur. In animals, such as these insect symbionts, the symbionts live in specialized cells in the body, but they're not living in the germ line. They're not in every cell of the host the way mitochondria are in essentially every cell of the host. So that's one big difference that might have an effect on how often genes can move between the genomes.
Okay, so the bacterial symbionts aren't getting proteins from genes that they've deposited into the genome of their hosts. But there's another interesting and slightly different possibility here.
There are also the possibility for the transfer of genes which are not donated by that same endosymbiont, but by something else, by some other bacterium somehow. So bacterial genes are found with some frequency now in eukaryotic genomes, and this is part of this subject.
So we've got bacterial genes inside of the aphid genome. They're making a protein that they're sending to the aphid symbiont.
The interesting thing is that this protein, which is encoded in the nucleus, first of all, it is not of Buchnera origin.
Or to take it back one step, the gene that makes this protein is not of Buchnera origin. You see, Buchnera are
alpha proteobacteria. It's a group of bacteria. And the protein comes from a gamma proteobacterium, which is a very different group.
So sometime in its distant past, the aphid had an intimate association with a bacteria, picked up some genes, and now those genes are providing proteins to the aphid endosymbiont Buchnera.
So this gene was acquired somehow from some gamma proteobacterium, became part of the nucleus, and now it donates its protein to an alpha proteobacterium. So there's a circle here. So it tells you that nature is that way. You can make do with bits and pieces in a variety of clever ways.
Making do with bits and pieces in a variety of clever ways. That's going to be a theme. But what does this bacterial aphid gene and its protein do for Buchnera?
Is part of a group called the genes for rare lipoproteins. Now, rare lipoproteins are a family of proteins which are on the envelope of bacteria, quite widespread, and they play a role in cell shape, maintenance, and in separation of daughter cells. They raised antibodies against this protein and found that, sure enough, it is made exclusively in a specialized cell of the aphid called the bacteriocyte. And the bacteriocyte is the place where the Buchnera, the endosymbionts, live. They only live there. They're not found spread out in the aphid. They're only found in a specific cell. The question is, what does this protein do for the Buchnera? And nobody knows. However, the protein is only found in what are known as mature bacteriocytes. So what gives? Well, You can hope for many explanations, but one of them is that the role of these proteins has something to do with what mature bacteriocytes are all about, namely the transfer of the Buchnera to progeny. So maybe there's a hint just by the localization of this protein in the mature and not in the immature endosymbionts, that this may have something with the function of this protein somehow in the handing over of the Buchnera.
As we said, Buchnera only lives inside of the cells of aphids, so its life cycle depends on it being passed on from mothers to daughters, and this protein seems to play a role in that.
Okay, so why is this exciting now? The reason for this paper being exciting is that we're talking not about the transfer of proteins from nuclear genes to an organelle, but from the transfer of nuclear genes to an endosymbiont. Okay? And the reason this is of some interest is because in the eyes of some, the distinction between the two, between organelles and endosymbionts, is mainly in our minds. Obviously, if organelles were endosymbionts, the difference is historical. But today, you can sort of say, well, endosymbionts are found in only certain cells. Organelles tend to be found in all cells. It's not quite true for chloroplasts, but it's by and large true for mitochondria. Very rare exceptions. Organelles look like bacteria. They don't really look like bacteria. They look like they were bacteria, but they have changed morphologies, etc. So you can say today you can make a distinction if you wish, but is that distinction valid? Now comes a paper which says that in fact you have this transfer into an endosymbiont, not an organelle. And therefore this becomes interesting. This is possibly a case where an endosymbiont is on its way to become an organelle. What's new about this paper is that this property of transferring the protein, which has a role, which actually works somehow, is a characteristic of organelles. And with one exception I won't talk about, there's some amoeba, it is not known to take place in endosymbionts.
So the humble aphid is blurring the distinction that we once made between organelles in our own cells and endosymbionts in insects.
And in a commentary which accompanies this paper by McCutcheon and Keeling, who are two people very much in the know of endosymbiosis and organellogenesis, they have a very lovely commentary. And I want to read a sentence or two from their commentary. Organelles were discovered first, have been studied for decades, and their bacterial origins dominated discussion about endosymbiosis and evolution for many years. They enjoy a status apart from other biological entities, derived from bacteria, but so different as to be given their own name. But the list of their unique characteristics is shrinking. Stable endosymbiosis promotes extensive genome reduction in the symbiont. Horizontal gene transfer from various sources to the host genome to maintain symbiont function. And now the targeting of protein products from host to symbiont has even been found. This makes clean separation of endosymbionts from organelles more difficult to see, prompting us not to look for the point when a symbiont becomes an organelle, but rather to ask, is there really anything so special about organelles?
The other question here is there anything so special about the genes of an individual organism? Maybe it is just a case of making do in the way that Elio described. It turns out that aphids are pretty good at making do with bits and pieces of genes in a variety of clever ways. Here's another example.
This case also involves aphids, and I believe it also involves a fungus that has actually, in a sense, given its genes to its aphid hosts. Explain to us how you discovered this and what's going on.
Right, so the P. aphid genome was sequenced earlier this year. It was published in February in PLOS Biology. And as part of that project, we had long been interested in this idea of whether bacterial genes had been transferred into the genome of the host. And so finally we were getting the whole genome of the P. aphid, so we could basically go through it and search for genes that might have come from the bacterial symbionts. During that search, we didn't actually look for fungal genes. We had a search strategy that allowed us to look for bacterial genes. We weren't really looking for other transferred genes from other groups, such as fungi. And so very late in the project, I happened to be talking to a colleague who worked on carotenoids, and these are colored compounds that come in yellow, orange, fruits and vegetables. Everyone knows lycopene in tomatoes, for example, is the red color. There's beta-carotene in carrots. So these compounds are often required by animals. They're often beneficial in different ways. And I was talking to him about carotenoids because many birds require carotenoids, and that's what he studied. He studied the red color in bird feathers that comes from carotenoids.
The classic example here is flamingos, whose pink color comes exclusively from the food that they consume. But you know, if you drink a lot of carrot juice, you'll start turning a little bit orange.
It was considered that animals never make carotenoids themselves. They always get them from the diet. So they seek out foods that have carotenoids in them in order to obtain these. And I just started thinking about the aphid situation and went back and did a quick search of the aphid genome to see if carotenoid biosynthetic genes would be present in aphids. And the reason for that was that over the years, we knew aphids had carotenoids in them. There was old work, you know, decades old, that shows the presence of carotenoids in aphids. And initially, people would speculate that these were being produced by the bacterial symbionts, but that basically had been excluded as a possibility because we have sequenced the genomes of the bacterial symbionts. They don't have the carotenoid biosynthetic gene, so they are not making them. And another possibility is that the carotenoids somehow come from the plant, the food of the aphid, and we couldn't really completely rule that out, but it didn't seem very promising. So I thought, oh, here we have the genome, let's just see. And amazingly enough, they had these carotenoid biosynthetic genes. So then basically the next step in the search is say, well, where did they come from? And so just doing searches of the database and doing some evolutionary trees and so on, it turns out these genes came from fungi. So they didn't come from bacterial associates. They clearly come from fungi, and we can even say a little bit about what group of fungi they came from. So it's the only case that I know of, I'm pretty sure it's the only case of transfer of genes from fungi to animal genomes.
A little update here. Since this interview was recorded between Carl Zimmer and Nancy Moran, a similar case of gene transfer has shown up in the two-spotted spider mite.
And clearly, not only transfer of DNA, but these are functional genes. They are expressed. We showed that they underlie differences in colors among different aphid genotypes. So, you know, they're acting in the aphid and affecting them in a way that we can recognize.
The way these genes act in the aphid is important in relation to the insect's two main foes. Lady beetles tend to go after the red aphids, whereas the parasitoid wasp likes the green ones. We're going to talk much more about the parasitoid wasp a little later. But for now, all we need to know is that these fungal genes and the colors that they produce can help the aphid escape one of its two natural enemies. We're not quite done with those fungal genes just yet, but at this point, I want to introduce the plants to this story. Once again, Elio Schachter speaking on the This Week in Microbiology podcast.
This is a paper about plant defenses and how they're set off by the presence of parasites, in this case aphids, with a twist. And the twist is that most aphids carry an obligate endosymbiont, a bacterium called Buchnera aphidicola.
Yes, our friendly resident symbiotic bacteria. Let's revise why these guys live inside of aphids.
Aphids are sap feeders. They feed on sap of plants. And saps are mainly sugar solutions. They are thin on amino acids and other things. And if that's all they ate, and they can't make all their amino acids, they would starve. In fact, it's quite a bit of nice arithmetic because they supply about 10 amino acids which are required by the aphids, and the aphids turns around and makes the other 10 amino acids and supplies them to the bacterium. The bacteria and the aphids are not just floating around all over the place. They are contained in a cell called the bacteriocyte. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's an animal cell and cell of the insect, which is, by the way, chock full of bacteria. There's just enough room for a nucleus and probably a few mitochondria. That's it. The rest is wall-to-wall bacteria.
Okay, let's skip back to the fungal genes inside of the aphids.
So when you see a pea aphid that's red or green, you may be looking at color that actually originally came from fungus genes that the ancestors of the aphids inherited a long time ago.
Right, exactly, yeah. So pea aphids, they come in red and green, and the red color So both of them have carotenoids. The red ones have an extra carotenoid called taurine, and which is causing the red color. But basically all of them have substantial levels of these carotenoid compounds.
So did these genes come from a fungus that was living on the aphids? Was it some kind of symbiont? How did the genes actually get from a fungus into the genome of an aphid?
We're interested in that. So the one thing we figured out is it happened pretty early in the evolution of aphids. So we have looked in different aphid species, and they all have these genes, at least almost all aphids have these genes. So it happened pretty early, which means 150 million years ago or so. We think it was a single event. So the fungal genes were apparently transferred as a unit, and they're still arranged in the same way in the aphid genome. They've kind of expanded and take up more DNA now, but basically the same arrangement as in some existing fungi. A lot of plant pathogens have, well, fungal pathogens of plants, so like the rust fungi, and there's one called corn smut that's a fungus. They have carotenoid biosynthetic genes, and those are actually some of the ones that are closest to the ones in aphids from the genomes that are sequenced so far for fungi. So possibly some close association with a plant and the fungus that was infecting a plant where the aphid was feeding allowed this event to happen.
Okay, so let's think a little bit more about those plants and the relationships that they have with fungi and aphids.
All right, so plants, they succumb to infections. In fact, we know that from history, infections that have caused enormous hardship on humans include the Irish potato famine, which is caused by a fungus-like organism, the oomycete, Phytophthora infestans. A whole banana cultivar called Gros Michel was lost in the 1920s to a disease called Panama disease, caused by a fungus called Fusarium. And there are current epidemics spreading through Africa and other parts of rust fungi that affect wheat and other plants.
So plants have it tough. And we haven't even mentioned viruses yet.
Cucumber mosaic virus hacks aphid behavior to maximize its spread.
That's Vincent Racaniello. He's a virologist and the host of a whole bunch of really cool podcasts that you can find at microbe.tv.
Do you want to handle this, Alan?
I think I can, yeah.
Excellent. That's science journalist and co-host of This Week in Virology, Alan Dove.
These folks, they're entomologists. So they were looking at feeding behavior of aphids, and they determined that aphids, if you release aphids onto a plant that's been infected with cucumber mosaic virus, CMV.
Now, cucumber mosaic virus is one of the more successful plant viruses. It infects more species than any other plant virus that we know of. We'll talk about why this might be the case a little later, but for the moment, let's get back to the aphids and CMV.
Not to be confused with the CMV that humans get.
Right.
So you infect the plant with this virus and you let aphids feed on it, and the aphids feeding on those plants will promptly leave those plants and fly to plants that are not infected if they have the option. So aphids don't like to feed on the plants that have this virus. It's apparently a lower quality, less attractive plant.
We don't know why, right?
We don't know why. This is just the observed behavior of the aphids.
Okay.
If you force them to feed on these plants, they are not as healthy. The aphids are not as healthy.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently they're getting less nutrient value from them. And I guess they have ways of sensing this, and they bolt and head off to plants that are not infected.
So you've got virus-infected plants that aphids don't really like eating and that aren't very good for them. This is the background. Now for the juicy bit.
Interestingly, if you let the aphids choose, and they haven't fed yet, you give them the option of choosing plants that are infected and plants that are not infected,
mm-hmm.
they will go first to the plants that are infected.
Huh.
So those
even
plants,
though they're nutritionally less.
Even though those are worse plants to be on, and even though once they arrive and start feeding, they
like
want to
like going
leave.
For the Big Mac rather than the healthy salad.
That's right.
So the virus makes the aphids go for the food source that smells good, but that isn't very good for them. And that was microbiologist Dixon DePalmier helping us out with that useful fast food analogy.
That's right. So it looks good from a distance, and then right. you get it, and you say, you know, that's really not quite what I wanted.
There's so much like that in life, isn't there,
Alan? Yes, they're really, really
So we're not done with the cucumber mosaic virus and how it influences aphid behavior just yet. But now I want to introduce another thread in these aphid-viral interactions. But before I do, I want to say that I'm not just randomly cutting back and forth between different aspects of the aphid story here. What I'm trying to suggest with this style of editing is something of the complexity of ecological pressures that the aphid is subject to. We're talking about one little insect here and a bunch of interactions that have been studied through the methods of reductive science. The point here is to not only communicate something of the complexity of what we know, but also to suggest that there is far greater complexity out there in the things that we are yet to study. But for now, back to viruses, back to what we know, and back to Carl Zimmer's conversation with microbiologist Nancy Moran.
Now, you've also been studying some viruses that get into the act in this symbiosis between bacteria and their insect hosts and make this whole picture even more interesting. I'm thinking of aphids that carry bacteria called Hemiltonella. So tell us about what you found out about what viruses are doing in this situation.
Yeah, so that's the other side of symbionts in these insects. So I've been talking about the ones that provide nutrients for the insect host, that provide nutrients that the host needs to live a certain way. But another thing that symbionts do in insect hosts and other hosts is provide defense. So this Hemiltonella defensa is a bacterium. It's somewhat related to E. coli, the Enterobacteriaceae. And it lives in aphids and some other insects. And is also inherited maternally from mother to offspring. But we also know that it jumps around. So it's not every aphid doesn't have it. It's facultative from the point of view of the aphid, even though the symbiont only lives in aphids.
So it's worth reinforcing that point. This is a bacteria that only lives in aphids, but it's not required by the aphid in the same way that Buchnera is.
And it moves around between hosts sometimes. And so when we started looking at these, one idea I had early on was that, well, these must not be doing anything essential for the aphids because they don't always have them, but they must be doing something because they're quite widespread and they're very diverse. There were different strains of them, and there's actually a couple of different species that are similar that we could find even within a single aphid species, say the P. aphid, which is our main model. And so the idea was that maybe these are involved in some kind of arms race, some kind of protection against the enemies of the aphid, so that these are symbiotic, but they're useful depending on which pressures are out there in the environment, which natural enemies are around.
Okay, so we've got a bacteria that might help aphids in some situations, but not so much in others. And it turns out that viruses are an important part of this story. But before we get to that, we need to get back to the cucumber mosaic virus and what it's doing to aphids.
Apparently, the plants smell good to the aphids, and the aphids go to them. And then once they start feeding on them, they figure out the plant isn't so good after all,
right.
The infected plant, and then they go on to an uninfected plant. Mm. Now, what these folks did was they actually analyzed the volatile compounds being released by these plants.
It's amazing.
After they saw this behavioral phenomenon, they said, this is kind of interesting. So looking at the volatile compounds that are being released, you find that the infected plants release more of the volatile cues that would attract these bugs. But even though these plants are actually less attractive, the plants smell better.
So the virus makes the plants smell good but taste bad to the aphid. Now, why would the virus do that?
And this has an obvious evolutionary advantage for the virus.
How so, Alan?
Okay, so the virus infects the plant, causes it to release these compounds that are going to attract more of the vector. I guess that's a piece of the story that I didn't provide yet. These aphids are vectors.
For the virus, right?
So the virus, on infecting the plant, it comes in on an infected aphid infects the plant and immediately causes the plant, or soon after infecting it, causes the plant to produce compounds to attract more aphids.
Mm. Amazing.
But at the same time, it makes the plant less tasty to those aphids. So once they arrive and start feeding,
right, they go sooner.
And they pick up the virus, then they want to go find an uninfected plant.
So the virus is using the aphid to maximize its spread. But this isn't about good guys and bad guys. As always, it's a little bit more complicated than that. To illustrate, let's go back to the story of the bacteria Hamiltonella defensa inside of the aphid.
It turned out that this Hamiltonella defensa provides a very strong defense against some of the main natural enemies of aphids, which are these little wasps, these parasitoid wasps that are used in biocontrol, and they put their eggs inside the body cavity of the aphid. So the wasp goes up to the aphid, puts an egg inside, and then the larva hatches inside the aphid, eats the aphid from the inside out, and then kills the aphid, and a wasp comes out of the body.
So this is a bit like what happens to humans in the Alien movies. We should point out that the parasitoid wasp carries a virus that is crucial to these interactions. The ability of the parasitoid wasp to successfully lay its eggs inside of the body of the insect depends on this virus that has been thoroughly domesticated by the wasp. This virus suppresses the immune system of the insect host, allowing the wasp's eggs to grow.
I cannot persuade myself that a beneficent and omnipotent god would have designedly created parasitic wasps with the express intention of their feeding within the living bodies of caterpillars.
Those are the words of Charles Darwin. So clearly for him, the presence of these wasps was a pretty good argument against intelligent design. But if we look at the ecologies of these parasitoid wasps, perhaps they can give us other kinds of insight.
So if the aphid has the right strain of Hamiltonella defensa, then it will be protected. The egg inside its body will hatch, but it will die right away, and the aphid will go on and reproduce and be fine. Okay, well, that's beneficial for the Hamiltonella because it's one way of it being transmitted. Its main way of being transmitted is when the aphid host reproduces, is passed to the offspring. So it protects its host, and then it's able to be passed to the offspring. So this is a mutualism. They're both benefiting. We're interested in how this worked. What was the mechanism? And one thing we noticed with, there was Kerry Oliver and Patrick Degnan were students working on this. One thing we noticed was that the genomes of this Hamiltonella defensa were very unlike the small symbiont genomes, such as in the nutritional symbionts we've been talking about. Instead, they're much larger, and they have a lot of mobile elements, and they had a very prominent bacteriophage. So bacteriophage in general are just viruses of bacteria. And these bacteriophage in Hamiltonella defensa had genomes that were very similar among different strains, except for one little region. And this is common in viruses in general, and bacteriophage in particular, that they'll have one region of the genome that's highly variable among strains. So when we looked at these bacteriophage genomes, there was one little region that contained genes that was totally different genes between strains. And we looked at what those genes were, and it turned out that they encoded toxins. And we could recognize this because many of them were similar to toxins that had been studied in mammalian pathogens, for example, human pathogens. When we look at E. coli strains or Shigella, some Vibrio strains, some of the toxins that we were finding in these aphid symbiont bacteriophage were homologous or similar to toxins that are found in mammalian pathogens that cause diarrhea and other diseases. So we knew they were toxins. There's actually quite a bit known. They're toxins specifically targeted to eukaryotic cells, so they attack the eukaryotic cell in specific ways. And we, you know, wondered why would a symbiont of an aphid have bacteriophage that have toxins that are aimed at eukaryotes. So they don't seem to do any harm to the aphid. The aphids are totally healthy when they have these symbionts. It's very hard to see any detriment. But it turned out that these toxins apparently are the key to the defense against the little wasps. So when we have one of these Hamiltonellas without a bacteriophage, it provides no defense against these wasps. When it has its bacteriophage, it provides very strong defense against these wasps.
A bacterial virus that protects the aphids from eggs that only grow in the presence of a virus carried by the wasp. So we've got three parties here, the aphid, the bacteria, and the virus, that all seem to gain some benefit from their association. But this question of benefit isn't always as straightforward as it first seems.
It's all connected.
They bring the virus
exactly
with them.
What benefits the virus. They take the virus all with them connected. To an uninfected plant, start feeding, and
amazing. And
this is the way we view it, right? But it could be, there could be some other rationale for this. But in our view of this situation, it looks like this has evolved that to spread the virus, to transmit it.
This is called viroposcentric thinking.
Exactly. I mean, they say at the end of this article that we need to study more examples to make sure this is what's going on.
And that there's not an advantage in doing this for the plants.
Right.
Or the aphids. Yeah.
It turns out there are some advantages to being infected with cucumber mosaic virus for the plants. In another study, scientists have found that the fast food molecules that draw the aphids in for an unsatisfying meal also attract insect pollinators. So for the plant, extra visits from bumblebee pollinators can help to make up for the not insignificant downsides to being infected with the cucumber mosaic virus. So what we've got here is two plant insect viral interactions. And it's worth pointing out that beyond the purview of reductive science, things are likely to get much more complicated than this. But even in the relationships that we know about, things are pretty complicated. Let's go back to the aphid bacteria virus interaction.
So you have a parasitic wasp that is attacking aphids, and the aphids have bacteria, and the bacteria have viruses in them that are attacking the parasites and protecting the aphid. Do I have that right?
Right. Exactly right. And it's incredibly elaborate and complicated, but when you think about it, the reason that this system would exist. So the bacteriophage are a very dynamic part of a bacterial genome. They can come and go. So you can acquire a new virus, a new bacteriophage. It has completely different genes in it. Some of them encode these toxins. And then it can be lost and another one can be acquired. So they allow a way for this system to be very dynamic for the defenses, the toxins, which are the weapons being used against the enemy. Those can change very quickly over time.
So it's the virus's speed of genetic change that makes it a particularly good weapon for the aphid in combating the parasitic wasp. But I have to admit, I'm not particularly keen on this weaponizing of the wasp-virus-aphid interaction. I reckon we can come up with better metaphors to describe what's going on here. See, all this talk of weapons and enemies puts us into a similar moral domain to the one that Darwin articulated when he said,
"I cannot persuade myself that a beneficent and omnipotent God would have designedly created parasitic wasps."
Darwin clearly didn't know about this association of aphid bacteria and virus that act to protect all three of those parties. Aphid, bacteria, virus, and wasp are all part of a dynamic and negotiated process of organisms living and dying together. The aphid's intimate relationship with Hamiltonella defensa and its bacteriophage would not exist without the wasp. So the wasp can be seen as a force that produces a diverse and complex set of relations. The talk of weapons and enemies doesn't really do justice to this diversity and complexity. For example, what do we know about these viruses inside of the bacteria?
This is not exactly like, say, a cold virus that somebody sneezes and it floats around in the air and then it infects someone else and invades their cells and then makes new viruses. These bacteriophages are actually putting their genes into the DNA of their bacterial host, and those bacteria can then pass down that virus DNA along with their own DNA. They kind of fuse together into one entity.
Right, exactly. So these these bacteriophage, in this case, they actually insert their genome into the genome of the bacterium, and they can be somewhat stable there. And then when they express themselves, they come out of the bacterial genome, and they make a lot of whatever proteins are encoded on the virus genome, which would be the toxin in this case. And then that bacterial cell has to break open. So when they come out of the genome of the bacterium, it actually kills that particular bacterium. But of course, there are other bacteria living nearby that are the exact same clone that don't die. So it's sort of the little group of symbionts in the whole aphid. Some of them are actually being lysed by the viruses, but others are persisting. And so as a group, they're able to express these toxins and protect the host, and yet they're not actually lost. They're still passed on to every baby that the aphid has. So it's a way that they can protect their own little colony and the host as well, and be spread to the next generations.
So while some bacteria are killed by the virus also protects the only place where these bacteria can live, that is, inside of the aphids. So viruses can be simultaneously harming and benefiting their hosts. And it turns out that this is a pretty good strategy. If you're a virus and you want to ensure that you get transmitted to the next generation, killing all of your hosts isn't such a good idea. Balancing those harms with a few benefits, a much better strategy. Now, we've looked at these interactions from the point of view of aphids, bacteria, and viruses, but we still haven't considered the point of view of the plant. Let's do that now. Here's Elio Schechter.
So let me give a little talk, a little primer on plant immunity. First of all, the immune system in plants recognizes the presence of invaders in a way which is remarkably similar to that of animals. It works by recognizing what are known as pathogen-associated molecular patterns, or better, microbial-associated molecular patterns, PAMPs or MAMPs. These are things on the surface of, say, bacteria and viruses. They include things like the protein flagellin, which is what bacterial flagella are made of, certain form of viral RNAs and so forth. All of these are recognized on the surface of animal cells by receptors. And these are called pattern recognition receptors, or PRRs. They're on the surface of cells. And the same thing is true on plant cells. So in fact, that our plant cells have a receptor to recognize bacterial flagellum.
Flagellum in general, tail or whip-like appendages that allow cells to move around. In bacteria, these tails are made out of the flagellum protein. This is a protein that isn't made by either plants or animals, a fact which makes it a pretty good target for our immune systems.
So plants know that there are pathogens around, and they do that, then the response that is set off by the plant is, in this case, is called PTI, which stands for PAMPs triggered immunity. So just like in animals, plants can set off this kind of immunity, and they set off a whole bunch of chemicals that are inimical to the life of the invader. However, the pathogens know that this is happening, and they make a second stage of response, namely, they make effectors to inhibit the PTI, to inhibit this PAMPs-triggered immunity. And so they say, you are fighting me, I'm fighting you back. But then the plants respond to that. So there's a second layer of defense mechanisms, which is you send me an effector that tells me that you don't like what I'm doing, I'm going to fight you back. All right, so anyhow, with that for a background, we will then consider what this paper says. And this paper says that one of the pathogen factors which is recognized by the plant happens to be not made by the pathogen, but made by its symbiont, in the case of aphids, Buchnera. So that's the background. The background is that a protein called GRO-EL, which we'll talk about, from the endosymbiont triggers host defenses. GRO-EL was discovered as a heat shock protein. Turns out to be a chaperonin, which is made in large amounts normally and is made in even larger amounts and comes into play when bacteria are shocked. GRO-EL is a highly conserved protein. It's very similar to similar heat shock proteins, which are found in the eukaryotic world. It's a fascinating protein. I think it's number 5 or 6 in abundance in E. coli, and number 1 in abundance in Buchnera, where it makes up for 10% of all the proteins. All right, so if you're going to pick a protein that's going to be recognized and serves as a recognition signal, you certainly want to pick on one that is abundant in such large numbers. Michael, I bet you know something more about GRO-EL that you want to say, do you?
Actually, yeah, there is something I want to say about it. My name's not Michael, but I'm going to steal his cue. You see, GRO-EL makes up 10% of the proteins in Buchnera, and there's a really interesting reason for that fact. When Buchnera went from free-living bacteria to living inside of the cells of the aphid, it started casting off a whole lot of the genes that it no longer needed. Think of it this way. If you're living outside all the time, it makes sense to carry around a tent with you, or in Buchnera's case, to carry around the genes that make the tent. When Buchnera moves into the aphid house, that is, inside of the cells of the aphid, it no longer needs its tent, so it can start getting rid of the genes that it might use for making the tent. It turns out that in the move from an outdoorsy lifestyle to intracellular life, there are quite a few things that Buchnera can afford to get rid of now that they're being provided by the aphid. The Buchnera genome shrinks as it gets used to this new domestic lifestyle where food and shelter are provided for it by the aphid. But there are some downsides to moving into the cells of another creature. You see, domestication can lead to a less active sex life. When this goes on for 250 million years, it starts to have serious consequences for the organism. Unable to renew its genetic material in the orgy that is free-living bacterial sex, Buchnera starts to lose not just the genes it no longer needs as a thoroughly domesticated creature, but also genes that are essential to its functioning as an organism. You see, genes make proteins, and detrimental gene loss means that those proteins aren't going to be made the way they should be. They might come out a little bit lumpy, a bit wonky, a bit wrong, which isn't good for the functioning of the organism. Usually, that wonkiness, that lumpiness, that wrongness can be corrected for if you have a large enough population of organisms exchanging genetic material. But inside of the aphid, Buchnera's opportunities for bacterial sex are very limited, so it has to come up with another strategy for ironing out some of the kinks that accumulate in its protein production. To correct for this detrimental gene loss, Buchnera starts to produce more GRO-EL. So how does GRO-EL help Buchnera with its gene loss problem? Microbiologist Michael Schmidt, I stole your cue. Please tell us what you think of GRO-EL.
I always have viewed it as the wonder protein. It's sort of like an usher, a molecular usher that escorts proteins so that they end up in the right spot.
Yes, exactly. Proteins in the right spot. You see, there's a number of very precise folds that go into making a functional protein. And when Buchnera starts losing genes, proteins start getting lumpy because they're being folded in the wrong places. Buchnera's solution is to make more GrowEL, because GrowEL helps all of those proteins to fold where they should. So GrowEL is like a pair of hands on the protein production line, making sure that all of those proteins come out working the way that they should. As you lose genes that would otherwise provide all of the instructions needed to make a properly functioning protein, you need to get more hands on the protein production line to make sure that those proteins come out the way that they should. That is, you need more GrowEL. This is why Buchnera produces higher amounts of GrowEL than similar free-living bacteria. So aphids have to acquire a bacteria like Buchnera to move into the plant sap-feeding niche. And Buchnera's intracellular lifestyle means that it has to produce lots of GrowEL to stop its proteins becoming lumpy and dysfunctional. And it's that precise GrowEL that the plant uses as a trigger for its immunity in its response to the aphids.
I mean, if you really sit down and think about the complexity of proteins and where they need to go, you can understand why in Buchneria there's an ever-pressing need for GrowEL. And I think what's really neat that you're going to probably get to in this paper, so I won't steal your punchline, is how GrowEL plays this role. And it's really about doing what the microbe needs done for the important or essential proteins so they end up in the right spot.
Yeah.
Well, bacteria can't live without it.
That was microbiologist Michelle Swanson.
That's right.
It's essential, so it's important that it be broadly conserved.
Yeah. It's also worth pointing out, as a quick aside, that GrowEL plays an important role in the formation of root nodules in the symbiosis between nitrogen-fixing bacteria and legumes. So GrowEL can help plants to form beneficial relationships and identify threats to their well-being. In the case of the aphids,
from the point of view of the plant, this is just a chunk of chemical. And in fact, it's so much just a chunk of chemicals that you can boil GrowEL. And since you can reproduce the phenomenon of setting off the defenses by using purified protein, you can do this with boiled GrowEL. Hmm. So here, GrowEL is not a chaperone. It's just simply a chemical that can be denatured in a denatured state, works just as well because some of the recognition material is present on its, probably on its surface. So I gave away one important part of the paper, namely that you can show that GrowEL is involved in setting off immunity by a couple of interesting experiments, and one of them is just that. You purify GrowEL, you make it in E. coli or something. Yeah, you make it in E. coli, and you purify it, and you smear it on the plant, and sure enough, you set off immunity, and you can tell this in various ways, including lesser fecundity of the aphids. In other words, the aphids lose their sex drive or something like that. They don't reproduce as much.
So plants are able to establish an immune response that stops the aphids from breeding as effectively as they normally would. And this immune response is triggered by GrowEL, a protein produced by the Buchnera bacteria that is the necessary endosymbiotic partner of the aphid. And that's probably a pretty good place to start our summary. So we've got the aphid feeding on plant sap. We've got its symbiont, Buchnera, providing it with 10 of the 20 essential amino acids. We've got some genes left over from a previous bacterial associate of the aphid that are now sending their proteins to Buchnera. We've got some other genes inside of the aphid that come from an association with a fungus that are now turning the aphid green or red, depending on the predatory pressures that it encounters in the environment. We've got a bacteria, Hamiltonella defensa, with a virus inside of it that is protecting the aphid from one of those predators, the parasitoid wasp. We've got a plant virus that lures the aphid by giving it the impression that the plant is cooking up its favorite meal, when in reality, the food it's preparing ain't that tasty. This, of course, is a trick designed to send the aphid on to infect the next plant. What else? Oh yes, we have the ants that milk the aphids for the honeydew that they secrete after a long day of sucking plant sap. Yeah, we didn't cover that story, but it's a good one. We'll talk about it some other time. And beyond the aphid-tending ants, there are whole realms of interaction between the aphids, other organisms, and their environment that we can't even begin to imagine. And we should point out that with the aphid, we're talking about a pretty well-studied insect. There are millions of species of insects that we know next to nothing about, each with its own set of interactions with other organisms and the environment. These aphid studies are like a tiny peephole into the mind-boggling complexity of ecological relations. Establishing and maintaining relationships with other organisms is one of the things that produces biological complexity and diversity. As human beings in the West, we've somehow created the illusion that we are separate from the kinds of relationships between organisms that keep all of life functioning. Studying and elaborating on the sorts of relationships that we've described here is ethical precisely because it helps us to shatter this illusion. The aphids and many other biological systems show us that there is no absolute fitness. Fitness is always relational. That is to say, biological fitness is dependent on our connections to other organisms, the environment, and the ecological pressures that are present in any given moment. We are currently messing with all of those things, and it would be incredibly naive to think that we can escape the consequences of messing with the interdependencies that produce our fitness as a species. That's about it for Aphid Hour. I urge you to go and take a look at all of the podcasts that I've pilfered to put this piece of work together. I'm going to link to them all through my own website, so you'll find those links at bendenham.com/aphids. Goodbye, and may all your symbionts be with you.